Today's episode is a recording of an event that was co-organized in September by the DCU Brexit Institute and the Friends of Europe. It is a European Young Leaders Forum called What Has the EU Ever Done for Us? It features John Doyle and Federico Fabbrini of DCU, Shona Murray of Euronews, Kensika Monchengwo of the Immigrant Council of Ireland, and finally, Oleksandra Matvichuk, head of the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2022. I highly recommend you listen right to the end to hear the last speaker.
All right, far be for me to want to interrupt the conversation, which seemed very lively and interesting, but just a few words of welcome. My name is John Doyle, I'm the Vice President of Research in Dublin City University, and it's my honour to welcome you to the university here today. And it is indeed a very warm welcome to the European Young Leaders and those who have joined us for the public session. DCU likes to describe itself as a European university which is based in North Dublin. And that's not just a geographic fact in terms of where we happen to be, but it's a statement of our values and how we like to see ourselves. We believe that the pressing global challenges of our time, from climate to security, democracy and social inclusion, many of which you'll discuss over the next days, will best be addressed if Europe is collectively engaged. That's not in a Eurocentric way or in a post-colonial way, but rather the reality that Europe's history, wealth, position, capacity at times to work together gives us the capacity to be a powerful leader on the world stage in these areas. And the values which the EU espouses, even if they're imperfectly implemented many of the times, are consistent with our values as a university and allow us to work within them. We also believe our students will be more successful. They'll be better citizens, better employees, better future leaders if they have a European perspective, supported in part through Erasmus and those sorts of experiences, but other opportunities, work opportunities and travel opportunities. And our university is committed to the European University Project, working through partners and the European Consortium of Innovative Universities to increase student mobility, to make that easier for students, to also ensure that staff are deeply embedded in European networks which lead to better research. And therefore, I really do wish you well this afternoon for those who join the public session and for the European leaders for your time that you spend in Dublin. I think the work that you're set in front of yourselves to develop a strong vision for a successful and inclusive and sustainable Europe is surely urgently needed. The challenges and all those issues at times seems immense. It's easy to despair, whether it's the rise of the far right or the incapacity to get political consistent messaging and agreement on climate change. But we do need that agenda. We do need a positive, forward-looking agenda which will deal with those challenges. I'm confident they will. So I suppose to finish up, I just want to welcome the leadership team of the Friends of Europe to DCU and to Ireland. We're really glad you chose us for your event here today. I can also thank my colleagues here in DCU who worked so hard to bring this event and make it a success. I assure you I did none of that. I just turned up here on the day. So in particular, Dr. Chrissy Petit and Professor Federico Fabbrini, who were really at the center with their colleagues in making this happen. And I suppose our wish is that this is a spark for dialogue, for challenge, for new ideas, for challenging my generation to go further, to go better, to do things differently. And in that regard, I wish you a really good warm welcome and good luck for your work over the next couple of days. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very, very much for those words of wisdom and insight. But mostly, thank you for hosting us at Friends of Europe, for Friends of Europe and our European Young Leaders Programme. It's great to be in Dublin, Ireland, a place of great hope, glory, challenge, opportunity, but also adversity in various ways. It's a place that's changed so much, especially in the past 20 years, as I understand it from speaking to local folk, because I took time out to spend here before the seminar, just to understand a little bit about the grist of the mill in different parts of Dublin. My name is Dharmendra Kanani. This conversation is, what has the EU ever done for us? So I'm first going to turn to the gentleman on the far right, the kind of snappy-looking guy with the black glasses that looks really cool, Federico. So he's a professor, a full professor at university here, and also of the Brexit Institute. And I forgot to say, I should also thank the Brexit Institute, especially Federico, for enabling us to be hosted here in this room. Federico, what's your response to what you've seen in terms of reaction by the audience here. Over to you.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks so much, Dharmendra, for your kind words of introduction and for getting us started with this nice Sligo. And let me also welcome everyone to the Brexit Institute of Dublin City University. I'm grateful of the opportunity of doing this initiative together. As you mentioned, Dharmendra, I'm honored to be a young European leader, I think class of 2022. And I'm proud that the Brexit Institute, which I founded now 8 years ago, is hosting this first day of the Dublin Seminar of Friends of Europe. So let me take a second to thank warmly my team, particularly Christy Petit and Lucrezia Rossi, but also the Friends of Europe team, especially Natalie Furrer, for making this work. And I also want to apologize in advance. I'll come to the question in a second, because unfortunately, despite hosting this, I need to leave at 2:30 sharp, run to the airport, and fly to Poland for a conference where I'm speaking at tomorrow morning. But I really wish to Friends of Europe every success for the next 2 days of events. Now, to the question you asked me and to the Sligo polls, actually.
Because there's a Sligo, but also you're the Brexit Institute, so you have a sense of, you know, people wanting to move in and move out.
Exactly.
So.
And in a way, the result of the poll you just conducted is a fantastic segue into what I wanted to talk about, because I had 3 points which almost perfectly overlap with what I think is the sentiment of the room. So the 3 points I want to make are the following. Number one is that the European Union remains the most successful political project in human history, as visible from the fact that there are an increasing number of countries that want to join and an increasing willingness by Europeans to see other countries join. My second point, which is the sort of the reverse story to point number one, is that recent efforts to pull out of the European Union have proved to be a spectacular failure, as visibly seen with the experience of Brexit. And yet, if Brexit highlighted the importance of Europe and the values of European integration, I think there is a third point, which was also coming out from the last question you were asking, where you were, a lot of people said we would like to have more involvement in the European Union and greater input into the functioning of the European Union. That's really my third point, that even though the EU is successful, it does still need reforms to enhance its effectiveness and legitimacy, to make it more capable of doing things and more responsive to the demands of the European citizens. And this is a direction that I think the European Union should take more confidently moving forward. So if you allow me, I'll just elaborate on each of these 3 points very very briefly, just for the sake of debate. So let me start with the first one, Europe as a successful project. I think history is a great evidence of that point. The European Union started as a project of 6 countries, and it now became a project of 27 member states, with a prospect of becoming a union of possibly 35 member states before the end of this decade. And it is extraordinary that when we see what is happening outside the European Union, in countries which are not yet part of the European Union, when people go on the squares to protest for freedom, democracy, the rule of law, to fight corruption, they wave the European flag. That's extraordinary. We don't do it so much here at home, but other people in the wider Europe look at that blue flag with 12 yellow stars as a beacon of freedom, a beacon of democracy. And I think that's the most powerful symbol, perhaps, of that attractiveness of the European project. Now, look at the reverse, and here's my second point, and I come to the core business of my institute, right? It's called the Brexit Institute. We've been looking at the interesting choices that our British friends have been making over the last 8 years. And I think, you know, they would now themselves acknowledge that leaving the European Union was the greatest act of economic, political, and cultural self-harm you could inflict on your own country. To the point that nobody talks about the benefits of Brexit anymore, and it's all about, let's try to see if we can find other ways to get back into the EU without saying it openly, right? It's hard to acknowledge the mistakes you make in life, but definitely Brexit was a mistake, and it has diminished the United Kingdom overall. And I'm not saying this as an activist, I'm saying this as a scholar who has dedicated a lot of time to looking at all the consequences of Brexit, and it's really hard to find a single benefit of leaving the EU for the UK. However, And I'm coming to the last point I want to make. Our British friends did have a point when, before the Brexit referendum, they were pointing for the need of reforming the European Union. And there were other people, myself included, who had been making that case from a pro-European perspective. If we want Europe to remain that beacon of freedom and democracy, we need to acknowledge that a union with an ever-growing number of members does require internal reforms. Europe has been going through a never-ending series of crises, the migration crisis, the euro crisis that almost crushed the euro, the pandemic. We now have the war in Ukraine. And although the European Union was able to go through this crisis, the responses were not always up to the level and to the expectation of European citizens. And why is it so? Because ultimately, we haven't really readapted our governance, the way how we take decisions, to the reality of an ever more challenging world and an ever more widening Europe. So I think here, and I will conclude on this point, we need to address this problem, and we need to respond to the demand of the European citizens who want to have a greater voice into the functioning of the European Union. As a lawyer, I can tell you this can only be done by changing the treaties, and so we will have to discuss this point, and I was reassured by the fact that the Commission President von der Leyen, in her State of the Union address just yesterday morning, did point out that this is needed. So let's see what will happen out of this. I'll stop here, and I very much look forward to hearing what my fellow panelists, Shauna, Kinsika, and Alexandra have to say. Thank you.
Federica, thank you so much. And again, thank you for hosting us, and thank you for setting up the Brexit Institute. It's much needed, because actually it'd be quite maligned, because people might think that you are actually pro-Brexit by giving the name that you have, but I love the way in which you've played with the politics of the name, so good for you. Interestingly, like, you talk about legislation and stuff like that. For those of you who are students and people from here locally, how many of you know that Ursula von der Leyen is the President of the Commission? Okay. How many do you know that she gave a State of the Union speech this week? Okay. All right. Good to know. Good to know. No, it's interesting. Let me not go any further on that. That's very interesting. It's very good to know. So you've made a number of points there, because one of the issues for me, I suppose me and us, is that when we talk about treaty change and stuff like that, that couldn't be further from people's awareness and knowledge of how they conduct their lives in Europe. If we think about our wider families and friends that may not come from the same circle as we do, they wouldn't give a scooby about treaty change, etc. So on that point, I want to come to Shauna. Thank you for being here. It's good to see you again. Shona and I, she's a journalist on Euronews, and both of us, when we just thought, because like, is this Shona? And you were like, is that Demetra? So we used to be on a television program called Raw Politics, which is a shame it's come.
Terrible shame, yeah.
It's a terrible shame.
Yeah.
And it was
maybe
a week.
They could revive it.
They should have to revive it, because it was a weekly show where it was this 30 minutes of, you know, Raw Politics. And I had the pleasure and the privilege of working with you very regularly on it. So Shona, given your experience in Brussels, you've watched, listened, and you've interviewed many politicians in your time. And, you know, even since we were doing the Raw Politics, when you think about in the 2 years, 3 years since then, the world couldn't have changed more in such a short period of time. And we're seeing that rise of a pernicious populism that's dressed up as normalcy, as if it's the only alternative to the woes of our lives. Give us your view on what politicians are doing wrong and what we might need to think about in terms of also your role. You know, if you think about the amount of airtime was given to Boris and Trump, right? You media people fed that oxygen every day and said, this is important to be aware of, rather than giving alternative news. So that's a bit of a challenge, I know, but you're part of this process of renewing our social contract with society. So over to you.
Yeah, I think we're just on that question. It's interesting because when it came to Boris Johnson and Brexit, part of the problem was that there were these empty promises and actual lies when it came to what Brexit would mean. And Boris Johnson knows the EU very well. He was obviously a correspondent there for many years. He lied to people saying that the British citizens would have the same access to the EU single market as before, but without freedom of movement, which is completely nonsensical, because why would that be the case? And I think that some of the problem was that when politicians like that go on TV and radio, often presenters don't parry them with fact-checking, or sometimes they can't because the lies can be so sort of grey and opaque. Like, for example, if a BBC correspondent is saying to Boris Johnson, well, you can't say that. Well, we haven't done our negotiation with the EU. We will get a better deal. So although, like, you would expect that politicians just wouldn't get away with downright lying about the prospects of Brexit and what would that mean. I mean, none of it has held up to scrutiny whatsoever. British people are finding that out now. And I also think that part from a Brussels point of view, when it comes to a particular rule of law, which is one of the areas where I just am so concerned, the Commission and the Council have not stood up to member states that have just spent years diminishing the rule of law, whether it's through the EPP and Orban, you know, since the early, about 2013, when he started really rolling back on democratic rights. His colleagues at the EPP didn't do anything. The Commission refused to do anything. The Council, and now you have other member states that, in the case of qualified majority voting, when it comes to Article 7 or something like that, it's hard to see that Orban can be sanctioned. So the EU itself is responsible for allowing this creep in of rule of law breaches. And just on top of that, because as you said, Federico, like people, countries aren't going to leave the EU because they've seen that it's not a great idea, it doesn't work out. So the concern is that they'll try to transform it from within and root out all of those, the social aspect of the EU, the rights for people, you know, well, and principles that the EU is actually founding, the founding principles of the EU, such as protection of LGBT people and so on. So I think that's actually a really concern as well when it comes to the far right, that instead of leaving the EU, these countries will stay in and sort of eke away or chip away at it. So that's a real concern. But I think just for me, one of the areas that I wanted to talk about in relation to what the EU has actually ever done for us, I mean, I'm coming from Ireland, and Ireland has been utterly transformed by EU membership. It's completely unrecognisable. There are so many different ways. So I'll just go through a couple of them. But one of the things that stands out for me is actually the rights of women and equality, because the EU was behind such important legislation. When Ireland joined the EEC, for example, it was found that some of the laws that Ireland had were incompatible with EEC membership, such as things like the marriage bar. Women were legally made leave work once they became married. Which was quite astonishing. It wasn't the norm for most countries, democracies around that time. There was also legislation stipulations around equal access to employment so that a woman can't be discriminated against when she's going for a job. Rights for pregnant workers, maternity leave, and just those protections. But Ireland at the time when we joined the EU was a very cold place for women. I mean, in the 70s and 80s, it's hard to say now, but young unmarried women were often incarcerated and their children forcibly adopted. We had a very, very strict culture here. And when we joined the EU, even alongside those laws that were introduced when it came to labour rights and so on, being part of a progressive liberal union, a social union, really helped. And it transformed Ireland in so many ways with that regard. And so much so that when Ireland did try to join in 1973, the government of the day tried to look for a deferral for around 5 years on any of the women, the equality rights that were going to be introduced. And it was interesting because I was at a speech with Emily O'Reilly, the EU ombudsman about this. And she has a great line in it. She said it was up to the faceless EU bureaucrats to protect the female citizens of Ireland and begin to restore to them a modicum of the humanity that it, their own state, had trashed. Essentially, the Irish government at the time was looking for a derogation on women's rights when they joined the EU. They thought, oh, this is going to be an economic union. And then in the reality, that's actually a social union. And so we have a lot to thank the EU for in that regard. One of the other things, which is very separate, is we heard this term sovereignty during the Brexit debate. And the UK, one of the arguments for leaving the EU is that the UK's sovereignty, we had been completely diminished, which obviously is arguably wrong, but anyway, that was an argument. For Ireland, our sovereignty and our independence has thrived and progressed. When we were in, you know, the 70s before we joined, we relied so heavily on the UK for trade, around 55% of our trade, our culture. We went there for jobs, and we weren't equal partners. We obviously had a very bad relationship with the British government, who was a former ruler, former occupier. When Ireland joined the EU, or the EEC at the time, we had an equal rights at the council table. We were a country in its own right that could make decisions about our future based on being members of this club. in turn, that sort of created a better relationship between the UK and Ireland, because the leaders, the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, could speak on the margins of these meetings. It then led to what could then be a proper conversation about peace on the island, because at that stage we had a conflict. We had the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, which literally could not have happened in this form without the single market, because the single market removed customs checks and checks on the borders, meaning that Northern Ireland and the Irish state no longer had a border, so people could feel closer, nationalists could feel closer. Also, both British people and Irish people had European passports, so you could be Irish, British, or both when you're from Northern Ireland. So the very, very sensitive issue of identity was taken away, which is why Brexit was so deeply damaging for the Good Friday Agreement, no matter what Brexiteers will tell you. And I think part of what we've learned from Ireland is that when once again we have this, you know, revived conflict in some way with the UK, where our relations are pretty bad and they're improving now, it was the EU and Brussels that defended Ireland and said, "Well, we will defend the Good Friday Agreement, even if it means that we suspend the TCA with the UK, even if it means our own member states' economies will somehow be damaged. Our priority is to protect a member state, and that means an awful lot." And there are just so many other ways, really, that Ireland has, you know, as the other piece is from the Ukrainian perspective, we are a non-formally aligned country. We're not in NATO. We're militarily neutral. So, but through the EU's peace programme, we can pay some money towards non-kinetic goods. So as we know, the EU has, for the first time, licensed and sent kinetic weapons to Ukraine. Ireland can't do that because of its military neutral stance, but we can send other non-kinetic goods. We can also do peacekeeping and training of Ukrainian soldiers. It's a small effort, but without the EU membership, we wouldn't really be able to do a whole lot more, or we certainly wouldn't be able to do that. So I think that the EU membership and Ireland, I mean, it's impossible to even imagine what this island would be like without it.
But before, no. But Shona, I loved what you've just said. And, you know, the fact is that history lesson actually within just over 50 years ago, the situation of women was dire in Ireland. And actually, you wouldn't even believe that if you try to even conceptually think that actually the lives of incarcerated women almost, you know, the value of women in society. And that in less than, you know, just over 50 years, it was like that. And what's changed as a result? And I think that's a very good lesson of how a country that at one end sees itself as a socialist country, a progressive country, yet because of religion and politics has been doing what it does with the role of women. And I think it's great what you said about Brexit, because I think the interesting thing about the debate when Boris was trying to defend the departure and said that, you know, it'll all be fine, the backstop and all of that will be right. But that's, I wanted you to just mention a little about the media thing, is that no one should have been in any doubt that if you're going to have Brexit and you've got an island with a border and you're going to leave the EU, you are going to have problems on that border, and without a shadow of a doubt. But you didn't have any public, reasonable debate of saying, Boris, you're a liar. And the media didn't even go there to say that if you actually use Article 50 to leave a boundary, and you have a boundary on an island, you are not going to be able to fix that overnight. But we had a kind of almost a pathetic, weak response to his kind of bludgeoning. Just briefly, next year we have the European Parliament elections. What do you see as the role of the media, Euronews, for example? What will you do, do you think, differently or better, to try and present a different picture of politics? If that at all. And I know you're not the editor of Euronews, so yeah. just share with your thoughts on that a bit.
I think there is a real fear that the European elections will probably go even further to the right. We'll obviously have a transformative then effect on the decisions that the Council made, that the EU can make because of the voting of MEPs. So I think I suppose it's our job to ensure that people are aware of what that will do, because. And it happens in Ireland as well. I think some countries don't, well, maybe it's just Ireland actually, don't really put that much effort into who they're sending to Brussels as an
not
MEP.
Is it not?
Whereas they consider heavily who they're voting for at home for national politics, and they don't realize, they think it's just this faraway thing that doesn't directly impact on them. But actually, you know, when it came to important things like the recovery fund, when it came to COVID rules and so on, the Parliament was really important. And so I think conveying that to people, that this isn't just a throwaway thing that you get to decide from a popularity perspective, or that you want to kick the government or the, you know, the establishment, that it's actually just a very important thing, and don't send far-right people who are climate change deniers, for example, to Brussels, because that will affect your future and the future of the planet, essentially.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I think I want to start by saying that when we talk about immigration, okay, we're talking about diversity. We're talking about ethnic diversity. And sometimes we're looking outside and we're looking for diversity outside. But what I would like to say is that within the EU, we are already in a multi-ethnic society. 2 years ago, I took a flight, 7 hour flight. I went to Martinique in the Caribbean. But I was still in the EU. Everybody there looked like me. They were black, with names like Jean-François, and they had the euro. We could use the euro, and I was still in France. But it was still part of the EU. So anybody from Martinique can come and live in Cork, in a village. Legally, they have the right to do that. Just like I met some Irish people there, of course, living there. And I was still in the EU. So already, what I'm trying to say is that to the question, what has the EU ever done for us? I would say it has provided a framework, a blueprint of how to deal with diversity. I'll give an example. I brought 3 euro here, okay? There's 3 euro, one from France, one from Spain, and the other one from Ireland. So this is the framework that we can take from the EU. The first one is to acknowledge, to recognize the diversity. So recognize that there is diversity. 20 different countries in a space, okay? Within that, you have 20 who have decided to use this coin. So the first step is to recognize there is diversity, okay? I use that when I talk to I'm a facilitator, intercultural facilitator. I deal with businesses, with NGOs, etc. The first one I always say, let's acknowledge or recognize the diversity in the room first. The second step was, let's negotiate that diversity. In the case of the euro, the French say, I want my sign of identity on the piece. I want égalité, fraternité, you know, on my piece. The Irish said, I want my harp on the money, okay? The Spanish say, I want my king. So what are we gonna do? We need to sit down and negotiate and come up with a solution. And the solution was, okay, on one side, we have something that binds us, a common ground, and the other side, we have something that still represents our identity. That's the second step. It means I can take 1 euro, I go to Martinique, I go to Portugal, or that 3 euro in Portugal, the same value, the money with different faces, but has the same value. So I always tell people, first you recognize the diversity, just like with the euro, you negotiate that diversity, then you can accommodate. So if you can do that with 20 different countries, you can do that in a school, when it comes to uniform, you can do that in anywhere, in any organization. Those three steps are recognizing the diversity, negotiating the diversity, accommodating the diversity. But then first we need to be aware that there is diversity, okay? That brings me to to something I want to do with you here to say, it's called awareness. In this time, I can talk about awareness of disability, of all different types of diversity, but I want to talk about color awareness. I want to give a little story. I have children, okay? I have boys, twins. They were playing a video game with some friends in the States. They didn't know the other, so they had avatars, so they couldn't see their faces. So I was in the room because you don't know what's on the other side. Maybe it's a pervert. So, you know, as a parent, you have to be there. So as they were speaking, the American boy asked my son, who's 14, born and raised in Ireland, Dublin. He said, "Oh, I like your accent. Where are you from?" He said, "We're Irish." And that was it. Okay, so when they stopped, I said, "Well, I thought we were Congolese." They laughed. So now my question is, we have to be aware of the color awareness. So my exercise today to you sitting here is this. I want you have a piece of papers and pens. Those who are in the back, maybe groups of four, okay? Form a group of fours, and those here on the table, just be on your table. I want you to have a list. On one side, answer this question. What are the advantages of being white in Europe? And the other side, what are the disadvantages of being white in Europe? Okay, so I'll give you 3 minutes out of my 7 minutes, and I'll get back to you.
I didn't know who was going to do that, by the way. I love your disruptive approach. It works. So go for it. 3 minutes.
Go for it. On the clock. 3 minutes. On one side, what are the advantages of being white in Ireland, and what are the disadvantages? In Europe. What are the advantages of being white in Europe, and what are the disadvantages of being white in Europe? I'm mindful of time, so for the advantages, you stop at 100, okay? Because we don't have time.
I'm going to turn now to someone who's done a number of great things, like other panelists, but you've achieved the Nobel Peace Prize laureate for Ukraine. Thank you for being here. You've been witnessing right from the onset what's been going on. You've achieved this prize as being head of the Civil Liberties Council, if you like, head of the centre, sorry. Give us your sense of... joining the kind of desire for joining the EU and the benefit it may or may not achieve, because we've heard so many people from the audience saying that it's a peace flag, it's a plan for creating justice and opportunity for people to actually get a different kind of deal for their lives. Alexandra, I'm very pleased to have you. Over to you.
Thank you very much for providing me a floor. I'm a human rights lawyer, and I have been applying the law to defend people and human dignity for many years. And at present, I and other Ukrainian human rights colleagues are doing our job in the circumstances when the law doesn't work, because Russian troops deliberately shell in residential buildings, schools, churches, hospitals, attack evacuation corridors, manage filtration camps system, organize forcible deportations, commit murders, tortures, rapes, abductions, and other kinds of offenses against civilians. And we are paying the very high price just for our democratic choice to join European Union in this war with Russia. Because this war started not in February 2022, but in February 2014. And this was a time when millions of Ukrainians stood up their voice against corrupt and authoritarian government and peacefully demonstrated on the streets just for a chance to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected, government is accountable, judiciary is independent, and police do not beat students who are peacefully demonstrating. And in these words, they describe why they are struggling and protesting to restore the Euro integration process. Because for ordinary people, joining to EU, it doesn't mean to join to some intergovernmental organizations. They don't know how Council of Ministers is functioning and what European Parliament is doing. It was a value choice. And maybe you know that in order to stop peaceful protests at the end of this revolution of dignity, there more than hundreds of people were gunning down on the main square of the capital, and people unarmed were dying under the flag of Ukraine and flags of European Union. And maybe we are the only nation in the world whose representatives are dying with the flags of European Union. So why I remember this? Because then when authoritarian regime collapsed, Ukraine obtained the chance for the quick democratic transition. And in order to stop us on this way, Putin started this war of aggression 9 years ago with occupation of Crimea and part of Lugansk and Donetsk regions. And last year extended this war to the large-scale invasion. Because Putin is not afraid of NATO. Putin is afraid of the idea of freedom, which come closer to the Russian borders. And in this regard, this is not just a war between two states, this is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And in this regard, this war has no borders. It doesn't matter, do we have courage to estimate it or not? This war has already crossed the borders of Ukraine. This war is here because Putin declared the war to the value which is European hallmark. Putin not just tried to punish the Ukrainian people for our democratic choice, which we made 9 years ago. He also tried to convince that democracy, rule of law, and human rights are fake values because they couldn't protect you during the war. He also tried to convince that state with a strong military potential and nuclear weapons can break international order, can dictate the rules of the game to entire international community, and even forcibly change the internationally recognized borders. And it's not just a task for Ukraine to prove that Putin is wrong. It's a task for EU itself. Because if it will not be managed to restore international order in the nearest future, we can find ourselves in a world where other authoritarian leaders will be encouraged by this example, where the rapidly increasing the numbers of states with nuclear weapons, where governments will invest their money not in healthcare, education, development, or solving global problems like climate change or social inequality, but into weapons and robotic armies. And in this kind of world, it will be dangerous to live for anyone, without any exception. The walls and borders can't solve the global challenges. The EU doesn't encompass the whole Europe. The current situation is dependent not just on decisions and action inside the EU, but also on surrounding of EU. And it's one case when you're surrounded by countries which try to join to European civilized dimension, and it's totally different case when you're surrounded by countries who want to destroy the values and your system. So in this regard, maybe I will stop on the point that there are a lot of things which have no limitation in national borders. Freedom is such things. Human solidarity is such things. We are very grateful to Ireland that you welcome, join Ukrainian refugees. I was told yesterday that you have 91,000 Ukrainian refugees. Wow. But the truth is that we need from you to do more. We can't solve this challenge in national borders. And this is not just our problem. The only spread of freedom in our interconnected world make our world safer. Thank you.
You've been listening to Decades, made with the support of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative, although the views of the guests are entirely their own. The Post-Brexit Europe podcast is a product of the DCU Brexit Institute. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano. Thank you for listening.